We as Catholics, I think, are called to be more discerning and a little more charitable and be cautious about how we label and tag those that are here from another country.
The legal tussle between the Trump administration and the federal courts over the deportation of these men from the U.S. to El Salvador sparks a rebuke from the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. We go in depth.
Igual ya quiero que llegue Julia.
I'm wishing for July to come so that my baby girl is born and so that she can also enjoy the rights given to her by the Constitution.
An asylum seeker legally in the United States worries about what will happen to her unborn child if birthright citizenship is restricted. Funding is terminated for a program tracking Ukrainian children abducted after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We talk about human rights violations with the head of the Ukrainian Catholic Church in the U.S.
I want to know Jesus better, and I need to go where he's calling me to go.
And the faith journey of an ultra-marathoner on a 100-day run across America to help make boys into men. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Process people for deportation, but make sure they're getting processed. Don't just load them on a plane and send them off.
A conservative Republican voice, a former U.S. senator from Florida. He's one of many, from federal judges to Capitol Hill lawmakers to members of the public, asking questions of equally passionate voices on the other side about the latest Trump administration deportations of illegal immigrants. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado, sitting in this week for Catherine Hadro. The push and pull between Trump administration deportations and court challenges grew as the week went on, after President Donald Trump suggested judges who issued rulings he didn't like should be impeached. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts issued an extraordinary public rebuke. Mark Irons reports.
The executive and judicial branches of government continue to spar after the latest migrant deportation directive from President Trump, the president's supporters on Capitol Hill backing his action.
What I have evidence of is that the people that he deported, that the president deported, are criminals.
But the president's critics say he's overstepping his authority.
The issue is whether or not federal court orders will be followed by President Trump.
In a post on Truth Social Tuesday, Trump called U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg a radical left lunatic of a judge and said he should be impeached after Judge Boasberg ordered the Trump administration to halt any deportations planned after the president proclaimed his use of the Alien Enemies Act. The president's call to impeach the district court judge elicited a rare public response from Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, who said, "For more than two centuries, it has been established that impeachment is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The normal appellate review process exists for that purpose."
I can tell you this, these were bad people. That was a bad group of, as I say, hombres.
The controversy unfolded last weekend after President Trump ordered the deportation of illegal Venezuelan immigrants who are members of Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan-based gang. The White House says the gang is known for brutal crimes, including murders, kidnappings, extortions, and human, drug, and weapons trafficking. Advocacy groups had sued on behalf of five migrants who feared they would be falsely labeled as members of the gang. But a proclamation from the president ordered deportations, and more than 200 migrants, suspected Venezuelan gang members, were sent to a prison in El Salvador against the orders of Judge Boasberg, who ordered any planes flying the migrants out of the U.S. to be turned around. But the planes went ahead, and the migrants can be seen shackled and forcefully walked by guards into the notorious prison in Central America. White House officials pushed back against the judge's order.
A district court judge has no authority to direct the national security operations of the executive branch.
President Trump used the Alien Enemies Act to carry out the deportations. The law has only been used a few times since its creation in 1798 during times of war. Some Democrats critical of the president for using that particular law for immigration enforcement.
My argument is that we already have tools that are available to remove undocumented violent people from our country.
The White House argues the Venezuelan government, led by President Nicolas Maduro, is closely aligned with Tren de Aragua. The gang was recently designated a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department.
The president is operating at the apex of his authority when you are dealing with questions of invasion and questions of alien enemy infiltration, as well as the expulsion of terrorist illegal aliens from the country.
But some family members have claimed their relatives sent to the El Salvador prison were not linked to the gang, which raises the question, should the migrants have received a hearing?
If this had gone through legal channels, we would know with certainty whether all of them are criminals or not, whether all are part of the criminal gang or not. At this moment in time, we really don't know.
Former Republican U.S. Senator and Catholic Mel Martinez urges caution.
I think it's safe to assume they probably are. But probably, if you're the 134th that happens not to be, that's 100% to you. And that's not good. And that's not right. And it's not just.
Martinez does say border enforcement is needed. And under President Joe Biden, illegal immigration got out of control.
The situation at the border became completely untenable. All kinds of people can come. It could be even people who are involved in espionage or other nefarious activities against our country. That's not good. So the border enforcement is critical.
But he's also concerned about Trump's push for mass deportations. He says it impacts undocumented immigrants and families who have been living and working peacefully in the U.S. for years. He encourages fellow Catholics to look at the issue with discernment.
I think what we need to do is be smart enough to separate the rhetoric from the reality. Not everyone who immigrated to this country over the last 4 years is a criminal. Far from it. We ought to be charitable enough. We ought to be Catholic enough to understand that we have to have some caution in how this is carried out.
President Trump's immigration policies go beyond deportations. He hopes his executive order to upend birthright citizenship will be upheld by the Supreme Court. But Stacey Bruston, the director of the Immigration Law and Policy Initiative at the Catholic University of America, says executive orders can't change the U.S. Constitution.
The concern that I have, and I think many legal experts have, is that this is not how the Constitution is changed. You cannot change the Constitution by executive fiat or signing, by the signature of a pen.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Despite the public warning from Chief Justice Roberts earlier in the week about attacking judges, President Trump came back at him on Thursday night with this posting on Truth Social. Stop nationwide injunctions now before it's too late. If Justice Roberts and the United States Supreme Court do not fix this toxic and unprecedented situation immediately, our country is in very serious trouble. It's not clear what he meant by before it's too late in this unprecedented directive from a president to a chief justice, but it did not deter District Judge Boasberg from continuing to demand answers about the deportation of those migrants to El Salvador. Lawyers for the Trump administration were called back into federal court in Washington on Friday. Judge Boasberg told them repeatedly this week the information they had submitted about the use of the Alien Enemies Act was, quote, woefully insufficient. Because the migrants were not afforded due process in immigration court and judicial review, it is still not known if every one of the men caught up in the sweep are indeed Venezuelans, are gang members, or even have a criminal record. The Trump administration's attempt to restrict birthright citizenship is touching a nerve with those it will affect directly. Reporter Roselle Reyes spoke to a pregnant asylum seeker legally in the United States who fears her child will be stateless when the baby is born this summer.
Is your family ready, just in case? What is your plan B?
Ay Dios, ¿cómo responder esa pregunta?
Oh God, how do I even answer that question? In reality, we don't really have a plan B.
As the Trump administration continues its crackdown on immigration, there is fear and uncertainty in the future for immigrants, even for those who are legally in the United States, like Barbara, an asylum seeker from Cuba. She is afraid of being on camera, but has agreed to share her story via voice interview. Barbara is not her legal name, but a pseudonym to protect her identity.
All of these executive orders that have been signed, in particular, this new administration has really robbed me of my sleep. And of course, the specific executive order that tries to do away with birthright citizenship is affecting me profoundly.
Barbara is 5 months pregnant and is extremely worried that her baby due in July will not become a U.S. citizen if the Trump administration succeeds in its efforts to end birthright citizenship. Since Trump's directive, a number of Republicans in Congress and several Republican state attorneys general have supported ending birthright citizenship, voicing concerns that the practice encourages people to come to the U.S. illegally so their children can have citizenship. But many legal scholars on both sides of the political spectrum say ending birthright citizenship would be blatantly unconstitutional. In 1868, after the Civil War, birthright citizenship was explicitly added to the Constitution when the 14th Amendment was adopted. It overturned the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision that denied African Americans the rights and protections of U.S. citizenship. 30 years later, in 1898, the High Court confirmed in the United States v. Wong Kim Ark case that children born in the U.S. to immigrant parents are citizens. 18 states and multiple organizations have filed suit to put a stop to Trump's executive order. Barbara is represented by one of those organizations, the Asylum Seeker Advocacy Project, or ASAP.
It impacts people who have won asylum, people who have won refugee status, people who have pending applications to get their permanent residency or green card. And so these are, not just individuals who are undocumented or who have been here temporarily, but it's people who have built a life for themselves in the United States.
Conchita Cruz is the co-founder and co-executive director of ASAP. Her organization, along with another advocacy group, CASA, and five pregnant mothers, filed a lawsuit in Maryland against President Trump's executive order.
We as an organization have taken a position that this is something that negatively impacts our members and we have to stand up to stop it.
Ya de por sí el embarazo es una etapa muy complicada.
Being pregnant is already a difficult situation, and now I have this double stress that my baby could be born stateless.
Barbara and her family left Cuba in 2022, as hundreds were targeted by the Communist Party after a wave of anti-government protest, and as the country fell into deeper economic crisis. According to a Human Rights Watch report, more than 1,400 people were detained, and Cuban courts convicted more than 380 protesters and bystanders, including several children. Barbara and her family feared they would be next, persecuted for their political and religious views. Barbara, her husband, their young daughter, and her elderly parents left their lives behind in Cuba in hopes of a better life in America.
No puedo describir el sentimiento de libertad.
I cannot describe the feeling of freedom once we were here in American soil. After we crossed the border, we applied for asylum immediately.
Barbara arrived in the U.S. 3 years ago, but their asylum application is still pending in immigration court. This can take up to 10 years to process. According to the president's directive to end birthright citizenship, the children of non-citizens are not subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. and therefore not entitled to citizenship. The Trump administration is now asking the Supreme Court to step in after the many legal challenges to Trump's order led to a nationwide injunction. The Department of Justice has filed three emergency requests to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking for the birthright citizenship executive order to go into effect until there's a ruling on the merits. In response, the Supreme Court has requested input by April 4 from the states and groups that have challenged the president's order. If the justices side with the Trump administration, the policy could go into effect in the 28 states plus territories that have not challenged the order. For now, it's an anxiety-filled waiting game for pregnant immigrant mothers like Barbara.
I'm terrified to even think about Plan B because, like I mentioned, my parents are 73 and 74 right now. And with an older daughter and a baby on the way, returning is not an option. That would be a death sentence.
What would be your message to those who don't really understand migrants and their struggles?
Firstly, I would ask them to open their hearts and to support us in our cause. We are people with hopes. We are people with dreams. We are people with desires to contribute to our community and to this country.
Barbara prays for the well-being of her family.
I hope in the name of God that we will be able to regularize our status, to win our asylum cases, and to live in peace in the United States.
Rosal Reyes, EWTN News in Depth.
Our coverage continues about the future of birthright citizenship, deportations, and judicial challenges when we're joined by our expert panel, including a former chief counsel in charge of deportations in a major regional ICE office, and this.
A new medical story details the important impact that hundreds of nuns have had on our understanding of Alzheimer's disease.
Johnny, he's like, I'm going to undertake this adventure of running across the continent. I'm going to run 3,500 miles in 100 days.
And later, taking to the road to run for Jesus. We'll tell you about this man's mission to bring the light of Christ to other Catholic men. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. We continue our coverage of the immigration controversies we brought you before the break with expert insights from a Catholic perspective. Paul Hunker is a partner in a Dallas law firm specializing in immigration law. He also served as the chief counsel for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Dallas for more than 20 years. And J.D. Long Garcia is senior editor at America Magazine. He has spent years reporting and writing extensively on the immigration issue. Welcome back to you both. JD, let's start with you. The narrative around crime and national security, which Americans supported in the election in November, how does the church work to bring compassion and dignity into this debate, knowing a lot of Catholics voted in this direction?
Yeah, I think that first of all, it starts with telling the truth. I think that a lot of the ways that immigrants are characterized is simply not descriptive of who we are. I'm an immigrant myself. My mother is an immigrant. I've interviewed immigrants for the last 20 years, and the way that they're characterized as villains, as criminals, it just doesn't fit the truth of who they are. The people that are coming to this country really are looking to provide for their families, and I think Catholics especially can understand that. We have families, we care for our children, we want to do what's best for them, and that's who these people are. So I think that the church needs to insist on the truth, and I don't think that that's what we're hearing from this administration at all.
Well, Paul, critics argue that using the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to expedite deportations bypasses due process. What's your perspective on this strategy, and how does it align with or diverge from the historical way that legal precedents have been used?
Thanks, Monse. The administration is taking a super aggressive view of what constitutes an invasion. And that allows the government to arrest Venezuelans with almost no due process. It's a very dangerous theory. I expect the Supreme Court will institute constitutional guardrails on the Alien Enemies Act or find guardrails in the Alien Enemies Act to limit the power. And that's a good thing because that will limit the power of future presidents as well.
Well, JD, you just talked about this idea that we are kind of stereotyping people. What is your response to those who argue that the executive orders and policies are legally valid, even if they're morally objectionable? Should moral teachings influence legal interpretations?
Yeah, in terms of like what I think that the problem is, I think we can agree that the immigration system is broken. I think that the laws that exist right now are out of date and they're not doing what they were created to do. So like in terms of legal interpretation, that's one thing, but we really are asking the courts to do too much, I think. What we need to be asking for is the legislative branch, right? The people that are supposed to be making the laws, to make laws that are a lot more clear on this. Instead, we're using laws that are very, very old that weren't intended for this current situation. And that's why we have a body that's supposed to be putting forward laws that actually deal with the moment, to deal with our current situation. Like our founders or people even 100 years ago didn't anticipate the current situation with immigration in this country. And so our lawmakers have failed us in terms of not passing the laws that we need today.
Paul, you were on the side of the government for many years. Do you agree with that?
Definitely need reform in our immigration law. The law is broken and we need some serious reform.
Well, Paul, I want to stay with you just on this issue of the 14th Amendment. It's significant here. How do you interpret the legal foundation for the executive order to end birthright citizenship? Do you think that the administration's interpretation will hold up with the Supreme Court or other challenges?
When I read the executive order the first time, I thought to myself, how to write an executive order that's 100% illegal? look, in over 125 years ago in Wong Kim Ark, Supreme Court found that a Chinese citizen born of Chinese parents in the United States is a citizen of the United States under the 14th Amendment because he's subject to our laws. So that's not going to change. I don't even think the Supreme Court will get to this because I don't think any circuit court, any lower court, is going to find that the executive order is legal.
So you really don't think that the challenge will go up at all?
Not to the Supreme Court. It could, but I doubt it.
Now, J.D., on these issues specifically, you've seen the church respond, the U.S. bishops, even the Holy Father weighing in on these policies. How should the church engage with government officials and legal systems to advocate for humane immigration policies? What does that look like?
Well, I mentioned at the beginning to tell the truth, but also I think that we need to continue to engage and we need to not back down. I think this is a moment for the church to truly be prophetic and standing up for the dignity of every individual. There's a tendency these days to paint immigrants with a broad brush and to characterize them in one particular way when what we're talking about are individual human beings. And so I think that the church needs to stand up and tell the stories of these people who are here, who have contributed to our country for decades, who have made their life here, who are part of our communities, they're our neighbors, they're our brothers and sisters, truly. So I think that the church needs to talk about it, to provide that counter-narrative of who these people really are.
Now, Paul, you've been on this side of these debates, and you've seen how the church responds one way or another. The storytelling that J.D. is talking about, is there more that the church can do? Is there more that a bishop could actually do to counter some of these issues?
Good question. My bishop, Bishop Burns, has an immigration task force to help the many non-citizens that are part of his flock. And education is really important, that people understand their rights, they understand their risks. There can be undue fear. People can fear driving to church or driving to the grocery store. And in most cases, those fears are unfounded. So I think it's important to really share information about the legal rights that non-citizens have.
Now, knowing that we do have audience members who are watching from all over the world who might be in those situations of fear, what would you say to them about those unfounded fears? What is legitimate and what isn't?
Well, the government is still generally focusing on people that have criminal history. They have expanded out to people that have been here a long time and don't have any criminal history. I think people should avoid driving if they don't have a driver's license. Some people can't do that. That often gets people in trouble. I think if people have unpaid tickets and things like that, they need to pay off those tickets. Non-citizens can get arrested on warrants if they have unpaid tickets. So I think people trying to get themselves right with the local law can reduce the risk of coming under the ICE radar.
That's good advice. Well, a question for both of you on this 14th Amendment discussion that we really didn't get into. JD, we've seen the church advocate for immigration policies as pro-life. Would advocating for the 14th Amendment to also protect life in the womb be a place for coherent application of church teaching, be an opportunity for the church?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the 14th Amendment, of course, it came up also in terms of in the discussions about insurrection as well, right? I mean, I'm not sure if that's exactly the right place to do it. I tend to think that we need something new. But the church, in terms of making that connection between the dignity of the human person from conception until natural death and including immigrants, I think that that's very important to make that distinction. And those of us who are very sympathetic to that point of view, to the pro-life movement, have to really call on our politicians who claim to be pro-life to actually carry that forward, and so that we can see some laws that do recognize that dignity of the human person, and not, for example, promote in vitro fertilization, which is against church teaching. So I think we really have to hold our politicians feet to the fire when it comes to upholding human dignity from the beginning to the end.
Now, Paul, is that too much of a stretch when you think about the idea that if it's a fetus, if it's a throwaway, it doesn't actually have the benefit of the right of citizenship? But can you extend protection to life in the womb through the 14th Amendment?
sure through the citizenship part of the 14th Amendment, you can do that. I know some scholars have said that unborn children may be protected under the Equal Protection Clause. I think there's a fair amount of debate on that. For example, I think Justice Scalia, who's pro-life personally, I'm sure, didn't think that the Equal Protection Clause would protect unborn life, but some legal scholars do.
It's an interesting debate and one we haven't seen too often. Well, JD, let's go back to this pastoral reality around how we look at immigration. How does Catholic teaching on immigration, particularly this call to welcome the stranger, inform your response to recent executive actions on birthright citizenship and deportations?
Yeah, I mean, they don't mix, right? I mean, I think it's very clear in the gospel what our response as Catholics is meant to be. We see our brothers and sisters who are very fearful, as Paul said. People are afraid. Even people who are currently protected are afraid. I interviewed some DACA recipients recently who don't know what their future is going to be under this administration. They have to do their renewals every 2 years, and they don't know what's going to happen, and they're living in fear. I think that what Paul said and the qualifications that he made about who is most at risk is important, because I think part of the strategy is for people to be afraid. But as a church, I think our response has to include welcoming these people into our churches and into our lives, so that they know that we're going to stand with them. And hopefully in that way, they know that that some of that fear at least can subside.
Paul, I'll give you the last word. The Catholic Church has framed these policies as morally troubling, particularly regarding human dignity and due process. How would you respond to concerns that ICE policies can sometimes dehumanize immigrants? Is there any reason that they would turn and look at the moral aspect of this rather than just the legal one?
As a former ICE lawyer once said, I always like to defend ICE, and the administration is imposing these standards on ICE. And I think a couple of examples are the removal of Venezuelans to very, very tough prisons in Salvador. Innocent people have been removed who aren't gang members to a prison that has nothing to do with them. I think going after people that have been here for many, many years, that has huge effects on those persons, their families, communities. It's really hurting our society to remove people that have been here a long time and have established ties. And I wish the administration would focus ICE on removing people that are dangerous to the country.
Well, this has been a great discussion. Thank you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
An important update now from the courts about the mass layoffs we have reported on for several weeks at USAID. A federal judge has temporarily blocked further efforts to dissolve the agency. In a ruling released on Tuesday, Judge Theodore Chuang of the U.S. District Court in Maryland said Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, overstepped its authority when it dismantled USAID. He cut off DOGE from ending any more contracts or grants, as well as firing any more employees. Former USAID workers, shown here outside the D.C. building where they had to clean out their office space, say those contracts and grants help vulnerable populations around the world. It's the first major ruling to limit Elon Musk's work in the federal government, and it could impact how other courts rule on similar cases. The next step would likely be an appeal. In another shakeup from the Trump administration, President Trump signed an executive order to close the Department of Education. At the signing on Thursday, he said the order would return education back to the states. This latest policy will spark a new legal battle. The president has made efforts to shrink the agency, but only an act of Congress can officially shutter the education department. A setback for the Trump administration's push for the biological definition of men and women. A federal judge has overruled the ban on transgender-identifying people from serving in the military. The D.C.-based judge ruled that the ban violated the Constitution and blocked its enforcement as the legal battle continues. The Department of Defense says less than 1% of the military, only about 0.2%, self-identify as transgender. And this update on a Social Security story we've been following for 2 weeks. Beginning March 31st, in-person phone service will indeed be eliminated for customers whose Social Security issue requires identity verification. Those customers will either need to verify their IDs online, which is a problem for many seniors who do not have a computer or have trouble navigating the internet, or they will have to make an appointment and show up in person at a Social Security office, another difficulty for seniors. This while Elon Musk's Doge is closing dozens of regional Social Security offices around the country and laying off thousands of workers who would otherwise provide that customer service. Retiree advocates say increasing foot traffic at field offices could cripple operations and make getting any benefits more difficult. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. That Trump call with Vladimir Putin, funds are cut off to reconnect kidnapped Ukrainian children with their parents, and some happy news from outer space back to Earth. A possible limited ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia tops the Week in Review. If it goes through, this could be the first time the two countries have agreed to pause attacks since Russia invaded Ukraine 3 years ago. The potential for the limited ceasefire came out of a call between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday. Putin did not agree to a 30-day unconditional ceasefire that both the U.S. and Ukraine have pushed, instead voicing support for a pause in strikes on energy infrastructure. The Kremlin has called for a complete end to foreign aid and military assistance to Ukraine, saying lasting peace would be impossible otherwise. Many analysts say those demands make it clear Russia is not interested in peace.
What I fear President Putin is trying to do is trying to create another frozen conflict. And frozen conflicts are contexts in which he has always thrived. He wants to make the job of taking all of Ukraine, subsuming Ukraine's government, its society, and its people. He wants to make that job as easy as possible for himself.
Just a day later, Trump held a phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It's the first time the two leaders have spoken since their tense confrontation in the Oval Office 1 month ago. Both leaders described the call as a positive move forward in peace. Zelensky agreed to Russia's 30-day pause on attacking energy targets. Trump briefed the Ukrainian leader on his phone call with Putin and also suggested that Ukraine could give the U.S. ownership of its power plants to ensure long-term security. The phone call showed a warming in relations between the two leaders after a disastrous meeting in February that led Trump to temporarily halt military aid and intelligence sharing to Ukraine. In reacting to these latest developments, some Ukrainian citizens worry the ceasefire won't bring peace.
Even if there had been a 30-day long ceasefire, this would not lead to anything because the Russians would break it. They say the Ukrainians would use this time to regroup. And of course we would. We have to prepare ourselves as we have such a neighbor.
Negotiations for the temporary ceasefire will begin on Monday in Saudi Arabia. But implementing the pause might be easier said than done, as all three parties have different ideas about what the deal should entail. As these negotiations played out, news broke that the Trump administration terminated funding for a program that tracked Ukrainian children abducted to Russia. Since the war began, Yale's Humanitarian Research Lab has collected detailed information on more than 30,000 children who have been forcibly transferred, fostered, and even adopted in Russia. Since losing their funding in January, researchers have not been able to access their database. Nathaniel Raymond, the executive director of the lab, spoke to EWTN News in depth in 2023 about this crucial work. This week, he called the cut in funding a catastrophic blow. For a Catholic perspective on these updates, we turn now to Archbishop Boris Gudziak. He's the Metropolitan of the Ukrainian Catholic Archeparchy of Philadelphia and travels to Ukraine often. Your Excellency, welcome to the show. Yale has found that thousands of Ukrainian children have been abducted by Russia. What is your reaction that much of the critical work to track these kidnappings has been stopped?
Well, it's really tragic. Let's just kind of put it in perspective. I think all our viewers have children in the family, whether as parents, grandparents, godparents, aunts and uncles. Think of those children. Think of those children being taken away to a country that is trying to destroy the identity of the United States. And think of knowing that those children are being brainwashed to hate America, to forget their families, to ever remember that they had these parents, grandparents, aunts or uncles. It's just inhumane. It's a crime against humanity.
Now, you frequently make visits to Ukraine. What have you heard on the ground about these children?
What can you hear? In many cases, there is no news. Clearly, the Russians don't want any trace of this whole process to be public. That's why this project run by Yale and funded by the U.S. government was so important, because it gave parents and family members hope. It gave a process for some time at some point for families to recover their children by saying, I know where my son is. I know where my daughter is. So this is very, very, it's very despairing. And of course, people in Ukraine know that the numbers are actually much higher than the 20 or 30 even thousand that are mentioned. So many people were deported, and so many children were deported from the occupied territory where no international agencies have access. So how many people were killed? How many people were abducted is really unknown. And the numbers that are used are kind of the minimal numbers.
Now, Your Excellency, aside from the cutting funding, during the conversation on Wednesday between Trump and Zelensky, they did speak about these children. And in a press statement, Catholic Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Trump promised to work closely with both Russia and Ukraine to get these children home. Are you hopeful these children can be returned before the end of the war?
Of course we're hopeful. We always are. That's at the heart of our faith. We're living the year of hope, the holy year of hope, and we're really focusing on that in our archeparchy. We just had a big revival based on hope. But whether I believe it's going to happen, I'm very doubtful, because Putin has not retracted any statements. He's not taken any steps backward. And he, in his 25 years, has shown that he just keeps plowing forward. So making concessions or returning children and thereby demonstrating that this act happened, that these children will be traumatized, these children will be scarred for the rest of the life. And to have those kinds of signs of cruelty and crime in Ukraine is not actually what I think Putin is looking for.
Well, we appreciate you and we thank you. Please be assured of our prayers.
Thank you. Ukrainians are very grateful for American prayers, for the advocacy, and for the material support, the defense support, the economic support. Ukrainians are really fighting a war for their freedom, but it's the freedom of all of us. And for a maintenance of international order of law, because if Ukraine falls, many consequences will follow. Ukraine gave up its nuclear arms for peace. Now all countries will think, if I can't defend myself with regular conventional weapons, we have to develop a nuclear arsenal. The consequences of Ukraine's fall are just unimaginable for the global community. And we thank Americans. I thank Americans as an American myself, but I relay the gratitude of Ukrainians for American support.
Well, we're grateful for you. Thank you so much, Your Excellency.
Thank you.
A shaky ceasefire is now shattered after Israel reignited its military operations in Gaza this week in response to Hamas's refusal to uphold the release of hostages, a significant condition for the ceasefire deal. The offensive began with pre-dawn airstrikes on Tuesday, killing more than 400 Palestinians in the Strip's deadliest day in months. Thousands of Palestinians who just returned to their destroyed land are now being called to once again flee as Israel sends ground offensives into Gaza. Bring them home now, a coalition of families and loved ones of these hostages says the military pressure, quote, further endangers their lives and complicates efforts to bring them home safely.
The resumption of intense fighting could lead to unintentional harm to the hostages by IDF fire or by execution at the hands of their captors. It could also result in the loss of fallen hostages beneath the rubble, never to be found.
Hamas has not yet responded to the attacks with military force, but said Israel exposed the hostages to an unknown fate. The ceasefire was meant to play out in stages, but negotiations for a second, more complex phase of the truce have long been stalled. From his hospital room, Pope Francis has released a letter denouncing the absurdity of war. This as people around the world continue to pray for his recovery from double pneumonia. Last Sunday, the Vatican released the first photo of Francis since his hospitalization 5 weeks ago. The pontiff is seated in his wheelchair as he co-celebrated Mass in his hospital suite chapel. Doctor reports from the hospital indicate Francis continues to regain strength. By midweek, he no longer needed a mask to help him breathe at night, and reliance on high-flow oxygen therapy during the day has been reduced. In a letter published on Tuesday, Pope Francis said his lengthy illness had helped him reflect on what brings life and what kills. Citing the tragedy of war, he renewed his call for diplomacy and encouraged leaders to find a new vitality to seek peace. As the Pope recuperates, the Italian Postal Service has seen a huge increase in mail addressed to the Holy Father. The letters bear stamps from around the world, and many are clearly written by children. Some of them are simply addressed, The Pope, Gemelli Hospital. And now, the conclusion of a story that has captivated America since last summer. Two American astronauts have returned home after spending more than 9 months in space.
And splashdown, Crew 9 back on Earth.
Sonny Williams and Butch Wellmore splashed down with another astronaut and a Russian cosmonaut crew member off the coast of Florida Tuesday evening. Williams and Wilmore's trip went from 8 days to almost 300 after a series of malfunctions in both their Boeing spacecraft and SpaceX capsules prevented them from coming home sooner. Friends and family were relieved to see Wilmore and Williams finally back on Earth.
I'm overjoyed. I know Sonny and Butch well, spent many years training and working together. I think the smiles on their face show just, you know, how proud they are to be back, how they think what they did was worthwhile, and the joy when they get to see their families in person.
While their trip was extended, Williams and Wilmore did not consider themselves stranded, as they kept themselves busy with research, spacewalks, and station maintenance. It will take months and even years before their bodies are fully readjusted to life on Earth. Next, groundbreaking research on Alzheimer's, all thanks to hundreds of religious sisters. We talk to the doctor leading the nun study about her findings when we come back. Almost 7 million Americans 65 and older live with Alzheimer's, a brain disease that affects a person's memory, reasoning, and thinking skills. As the country's population ages, that number is expected to grow. And researchers are working to not only deepen their understanding of what causes the disease, but how to cure it. One decades-long study continues to discover vital information on Alzheimer's, thanks to its unique group of participants from the convent. The Nun Study began in 1991 by Dr. David Snowden, who asked members of the School Sisters of Notre Dame to participate. Almost 700 sisters 75 years or older initially agreed to take part in the study from across the country. The sisters underwent annual cognitive assessments for the rest of their lives, allowed researchers access to their convents and medical records, and donated their brains for research after death. A new study by the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio details the more than 30 years of non-study research and the key discoveries found from the sisters' data even after they passed away. Dr. Margaret Flanagan is an associate professor at the UT Health San Antonio and directs the non-study at the center's Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases. She joins us now to discuss this insightful report. Welcome, Dr. Flanagan. These nuns became a very unique test group for researching cognitive decline. Tell us, how did this study begin and what made the sisters such a special group of participants?
Sure. Yeah. So Dr. Snowden is the researcher who started the nun study, as you mentioned, and he was an epidemiologist. So in the field of epidemiology, researchers tend to focus on, you know, different exposures, risk factors, and things like that to study disease and their design. And when Dr. Snowden connected with the School Sisters of Notre Dame, he found them to be an ideal study group because they shared so many things about their lifestyle. So, for example, they lived in, similar housing. They had similar access to health care and dental care. They had, about the same opportunities to pursue education, similar risk factors, and we're a very homogeneous group. So I believe he even had a quote saying that other than the nun study, it would be pretty challenging to find such a perfect group to study outside of a laboratory setting. So
yeah. Incredible to be able to eliminate all of these variables because of how providentially they came together. Well, what these nuns agreed to, Dr. Flanagan, was quite the commitment. They opened their lives to research for years. Why did they agree to participate? Do you have an insight into what motivated them?
So, from my own experience with the sisters, I would say they are a group of individuals who are very passionate about education in addition to helping others. So I think those two things really helped encourage and inspire and motivate them to continue such a high level of participation because they knew that they were giving back to, both students for the future who can use the materials to learn from, as well as contributing to finding cures for Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementias that impact so many people nowadays. So
I'm sure their faith has a lot to do with it, too. But tell us about your team's most recent study out of UT Health San Antonio. What has the nun study showed you about aging and dementia?
Yeah, so I mean, it's 30 years, so I don't have time to go through everything. So maybe I can touch on just some of the key things. For example, in the nun study, it was shown that the sisters who had a more optimistic or glass half full outlook on life were less likely to develop dementia versus those who were more pessimistic. Key finding from the nun study that we highlight in the paper is that you can actually things that you do when you're much younger and, education or things like that may actually be very important in determining whether or not one develops Alzheimer's or dementia. So specifically, the sisters, when they became sisters between around 18 to 22 years old, wrote autobiography stories in the form of essays. And these essays were analyzed very carefully. And interestingly, in the essays that had more complex language and something that was referred to as a higher idea density, those sisters were less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease or dementia later in life than those who had kind of more concise, basic writing. So I think that's fascinating and really highlights how, early experiences or things can really impact how things go further down the road.
The outcome at the end of your life, of course. Well, quickly, looking more broadly at the efforts to cure Alzheimer's and other types of dementia, what gives you hope? Can you say that we're making progress toward a world without these issues?
Yeah, I think we're making huge progress, actually. And I just want to kind of highlight that from my lab, working with the Nun Study, we did a study where we looked at the Nun Study and two other additional longitudinal studies of aging. And it was over 1,000 individuals that we studied their brains. And what we found that really was surprising, but very important and gives us a lot of hope is that in individuals with the memory problems and Alzheimer's dementia, it was actually most common to have combinations of multiple brain problems at the same time. So not just Alzheimer's disease amyloid beta, for example. It was, you know, combinations of different proteins or vascular problems that were sort of all contributing to the memory problems. So I think this gives us a lot of hope now that we know that, you know, combinations of multiple diseases going on in the brain are the most common in people, that we can really continue to move research forward to develop different tests that we can, you know, do blood tests, for example, during life
to determine
unique combination that specific person has to have a more personalized medicine approach. So I think that gives us a lot of hope.
Definitely a lot to be hopeful for and to remember to remain joyful in our dispositions as well to ward all of these issues away. Thank you so much, Dr. Flanagan.
Thank you. Yeah.
We need to be ready and willing to pay the price and to sacrifice ourselves to bring life to the people around us.
A man of determination running across the United States in 100 days. When we come back, his powerful story of faith and what he wants to teach boys about becoming men.
Can you even imagine running 35 miles every day for 100 days in a row? Ultramarathoner Johnny Kuplek is doing just that right now, running across the United States from California to New York. It's all part of his effort to raise awareness and funds for his Catholic mentorship program called Sebaste, which helps boys develop into virtuous men. We found Johnny on his faith journey in depth near the halfway point of his ultra marathon in Kansas when he stopped to speak to the students at St. Martin's Academy.
We're made to be great saints, and we can't be afraid to undertake great things in the name of Jesus Christ. And no matter the little we have, offer that. For me, it's running. You know what? I'm going to give what I have, and we're going to use the little gift to try and spread a bigger message through that, but not to be afraid of pursuing great things in our life. The mission of Sebaste is to help free men so they can enter into right relationship with Jesus Christ and become man fully alive, which is to be a great saint. That is, everything we do is geared towards that end. This is a mission that God has put on our hearts. And how do we help these guys become great saints and just live a flourishing human life as a man with all the adventure, the beauty, the poetry, the prayer, but most importantly, turning your heart to God and understanding your identity as a true son of God the Father.
I first met Johnny Kuplak when he was a freshman at St. Gregory's Academy in Northeast Pennsylvania. And I was his teacher and house father there at the academy. He had a kind of fire and a kind of intensity and an unbelievable will. You could tell pretty quickly he was an extraordinary young man. And so from that grew a friendship, and we've kept in touch over the years. And I have an incredible amount of admiration and respect for him and what he's doing and what Sebaste and that program stands for. I think our mission and our vision is in very close alignment. I know at Sebaste they want to help young men realize their full potential in the image and likeness of God. That's our mission here. And we see the path to that being a path that leads through difficulty.
I had recently gotten into ultra running. I had some pretty early success with my first 10 races. And so we thought, why don't we use this running platform that Johnny's already doing, and let's use this to spread the message.
That's how everybody was in first love.
Maybe some of you guys have gone to a place in your life where you're so sick of sinning
and you're so sick of committing the same sins and you feel like trash, it's in that exact moment where he wants you the most. Sometimes you're in a lot of physical pain. We bury a lot of stuff deep in our hearts. And sometimes it takes an immense amount of physical pain to bring that out. But when you're in a lot of physical pain, you're not strong enough to keep those things in there anymore. They start coming out. Guys, God wants to come into that space. Jesus Christ wants to come into that space right there. Invite him into that.
I think running an ultra marathon is incredible. I've never considered that for myself, but it'd definitely be just the amount of fortitude it requires to do that. You have your interior life together if you were able to accomplish that.
How he runs a marathon every day, it's amazing how he does it. Takes one day at a time and offers it up to our Lord. That just inspires me to take one day at a time and offer each day to our Lord.
Like he said, like running through walls rather than just hitting them and stopping. You really want to push through those hardships in your life.
Johnny is a extremely holy and extremely intense man. And I have the blessing and the privilege to call him my friend. He served as inspiration for me to do a lot of things. And now I get to be on this journey with him.
When you're doing something this physical for this long, you start to see yourself more clearly. It's almost like God reveals myself to me. It's more of a true humility of like the truth about myself, about my own weaknesses and shortcomings. And I think the biggest thing is in just moments of weakness and sin, coming to know in a new way Jesus in that moment and inviting him into that space and not being ashamed of that, but learning to kind of relish that moment. And that's helped me understand him in a totally new way.
So far, Johnny's 100-day run is on schedule. He plans to arrive at his final destination of the Shrine of the North American Martyrs in Orrisville, New York, on Divine Mercy Sunday, April 27th. If you would like to find out more about his apostolate, Sebaste, go to this website at sebaste.org. That does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. We hope to see you then.